The 1995 Sandstone Symposium presents session number 222, Mormon Biography, Its Paradoxes, Progress, and Problems, by Noel J. Bringhurst.
We'd like to welcome you to this session of Sunstone. This is, actually I didn't even write down what the topic of it, but this is Noel Bringhurst's session on biographies. If this is what you wanted to be in, then you're in the right session. If it's not, then you're not. just making sure. Noel Bringhurst is a professor at the Sequoia National or the College of the Sequoias in California. He teaches history and political science. He got his master's and his bachelor's at the University of Utah and then continued on and got his doctorate at the University of California. He has published a couple of books, Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, The Changing Place of Blacks Within Mormonism, and Brigham Young and the Expanding American Frontier. He's been published widely in many of the magazines, the Utah Historical Quarterly, the Michigan History, the Pacific Historical Review, the Utah Historical Quarterly, Dialogue, Pacific Historical Review, and the Journal of Mormon History. His article in the Utah Historical Quarterly back in 1989 on Fon Brody, No Man Knows My History, won him the best article for that particular year written in the Historical Quarterly, and he did just mention that the following year he was also able to win another award. He has written a lot of articles, mostly those concerning blacks and the Mormon Church and how they impact each other, and also on Fon Brody. He is currently writing a biography on Fon Brody, and therefore he's been here participating in the Fon Brody Symposium on Wednesday, and also he participated Wednesday night in this plenary session, if you were there. I was intrigued with all of the conflict and whatnot going on with Fon Brody, that he finds her very an outstanding teacher and a scholar and very effective in the classroom. I think we can find what we want from when we look back into people's lives. He has received several awards and grants. He has spent from 1988 and 1989 on sabbatical doing research for Fon Brody. He was also in 1987 was given the Associated Student Body Faculty Recognition Award, and also he was a participant in the California Great Teacher Seminar. Those particularly appeal to me because that tells you what kind of a teacher he is if he's becoming a favorite that he teaches. And we'll turn the time now over to Dr. Bringhurst.
Chris, I thank you very much for that gracious introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here today and to be able to talk a little bit about Mormon biography. I want to put this speech. I know I'm probably going to say a lot of things critical about Mormon biography as I go along. The current status of Mormon biography, the paradoxes and the problems. But I'm also going to talk about the progress. And I guess I should add a fourth P. And the potential, because I think there's a lot of potential. My father always taught me, who's out in the audience, he says, always look at the cup being half full rather than half empty. That was one of my father's favorite expressions. And I think that's that's what I want to try to do today is you know, there might be an image that the cup is half empty, but I think it's half full, too, and it's maybe more than half full because of the potential. There's a lot of exciting potential, I think, in the area of Mormon biography, and I hope to leave some time that you can ask questions and we can maybe pursue that a little bit more. In 1978, the non-Mormon anthropologist Mark Leone characterized Mormon biography as amateur history. Despite Mormonism's vigorous tradition of having produced thousands of personal journals and family histories, Mormon biography, he is basically chronicle and vignette, not interpretations. Its skeleton is kinship, not politics or economics, and it is unreservedly uncritical. Similarly, Mormon historians James B. Allen and Glenn M. Leonard noted that while biographical studies of Latter-day Saints are numerous, few are professionally done, and many give only a selective look at the life of the individual. And Davis Bitten, one-time assistant church historian back in the early 1970s, critically observed that while the inherent interest and quality of records for writing Mormon biography are great, the results to date have been mediocre. The starting point for all Mormon biography is Mormonism's founder, Joseph Smith, Jr., who is indeed the beginning point for all Mormon historical writing. Appropriately and with some irony, Fawn M. Brody's controversial No Man Knows My History, The Life of Joseph Smith, marks the beginning point of modern Mormon biography, produced within the context of the new Mormon history. Brody's seminal study encapsulates the progress, along with the paradoxes and problems inherent in Mormon biography. No Man Knows My History, upon its publication in 1945, quickly established itself as something of a watershed in Mormon biography, setting the agenda for a new generation of studies on Mormons. Gracefully written, with a compelling momentum, which set it apart from earlier accounts of Mormonism's founder, Brody's Joseph Smith is interesting, a flesh-and-blood person with whom one can have sympathy, concedes historian, Latter-day Saint scholar Davis Bitten. Brody, moreover, placed her subject within an analytical framework, one which was explicitly psychoanalytical, distinguishing it from earlier biographies. But at the same time, Brody's work betrayed a fundamental paradox, and indeed problem. This work, in the words of David J. Whitaker, represented the biographical craft at its worst. A secular portrait of a religious man. Brody discounted, ignored, and or simply rationalized the religious strivings and mystic experiences of Joseph Smith. This tendency was reinforced by Brody's heavy, often uncritical reliance on non-Mormon and anti-Mormon writings. Brody's study, moreover, was limited by the unavailability of certain crucial primary documents written by Joseph Smith himself and other individuals close to him. If any of you were at the symposium, you know, some of these problems, some of these issues were discussed and brought out. A second, more recent biography useful in gaining a fuller picture of Joseph Smith is Donna Hill's Joseph Smith, the First Mormon. Hill, unlike Brody, had access to important source materials, including diaries, letters, and other primary documents. Hill, moreover, was able to incorporate recent methodology and scholarship into forging what Davis Bitten has characterized a more positive yet frank portrait of Smith. But at the same time, Hill's basic narrative is unfortunately bland and uninspiring, standing in sharp contrast to Brody's lively, engaging presentation. It also has one other serious flaw. It lacks a clear analytical framework. Also noteworthy is Richard L. Bushman's 1984 work, Joseph Smith and the Beginnings of Mormonism. But Bushman's study is not a full-scale biography, only taking the life and activities of Joseph Smith up to 1831. Thus, the first-rate definitive biography of Mormonism's founder remains to be written. And I guess that was brought out very clearly at the symposium as well. Brigham Young's second president of the Mormon Church, is the subject of Leonard J. Arrington's extensively researched and carefully written Brigham Young, American Moses. Arrington's biography comes closest to a definitive biography, presenting the Mormon leader in a generally favorable light, while at the same time noting with candor
Young's difficulties and varied shortcomings. Arrington, however, avoids certain controversial topics, including Young's response to and handling of certain critical conflicts and divisions within Mormonism, and tensions within Young's own large, diffuse family. Thus, as with Joseph Smith, I feel the truly definitive biography on Brigham Young still remains to be written. Efforts to examine the lives of subsequent presidents of the Mormon Church have been even more limited and less satisfactory. John Taylor, third president of the church, from 1880 to 1887, has been considered in a book-length study by Samuel W. Taylor, the Mormon leader's grandson. Sam Taylor's The Kingdom or Nothing is written in a lively, engaging style, consistent with this talented author's numerous and varied fictional works. But, at the same time, Taylor's controversial conclusions are frequently based on speculation and limited historical evidence. Thomas G. Alexander's Things in Heaven and Earth, The Life and Times of Wilford Woodruff, a Mormon prophet, examines Taylor's successor in the presidential office from 1889 to 1898. Alexander's carefully researched and written work offers the most complete examination and only interpretation of Woodruff's life. Unfortunately, there are no satisfactory scholarly book-length biographies of Woodruff's two immediate successors in the presidential office, namely Lorenzo Snow and Joseph F. Smith. Likewise, Heber J. Grant, who came next, serving from 1918 to 1945, also lacks a book-length study. George Albert Smith, who succeeded Grant in presiding over the Mormon Church from 1945 to 51, has attracted the attention of a careful, competent writer, Merlo Hussey, who presents Smith within an engaging book-length three-generation study of the Smith family entitled Builders of the Kingdom, George A. Smith, John Henry Smith, and George Albert Smith. Smith's three immediate successors as church president have not had the benefits of careful scholarly biographical examination, namely David O. McKay, although I might mention that there is a biography being undertaken at this time that I think is going to really provide some interesting insights. Gregory Prince is presently working on David O. McKay. He just finished doing a work on early Mormon origins. Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold Bealey are the other two lacking a first-rate biography. Now, by contrast, President Spencer W. Kimball, who followed Harold Bealey, has found his very competent, able biographers in Edward L. Kimball and Andrew E. Kimball. Their excellent Spencer W. Kimball, 12th president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, quickly established itself as the ideal scholarly model for all future biographies of 20th century Mormon presidents. The authors, son of President Kimball, were fortunate in having a subject whose life was unusually varied and interesting. In addition, as family members, the Kimballs were granted direct access to the Mormon leader's personal diaries. Also, the authors were refreshingly frank and open in presenting their subject. The authors, moreover, were able to write and put together a well-paced biography that convinces by recounting numerous specific experiences. By contrast, Ezra Taft Benson, Kimball's successor as church president, has not attracted a biographer of similar ability. Howard W. Hunter, the recently deceased 14th president of the church, has had his pre-presidential activities chronicled with a degree of forthrightness by Eleanor Knowles in a generally sympathetic work. In summary, therefore, the overwhelming majority of Mormon church presidents await serious biographical attention based on thorough research and careful scholarly analysis. Similarly, the number of outstanding book-length biographies on church leaders below the level of Mormon church president is also limited. Among the early associates of Joseph Smith to receive adequate, if not definitive, treatment are Oliver Cowdery and Sidney Rigdon, although I should mention that Sidney Rigdon just recently has found his very capable biographer in Richard S. Van Wagner, Sidney Rigdon, A Portrait of Religious Excess. That book, in fact, received the Best Biography Award from the Mormon History Association. It's very, very good. Heber C. Kimball, a member of the Council of the Twelve, or so-called general authority, an associate of both Joseph Smith and later Brigham Young, has found a competent biographer as well in Stanley B. Kimball, who's thoroughly researched and carefully written. Heber C. Kimball, Mormon patriarch and pioneer, is a model work. Setting the standard for biographies of more recent Mormon general authorities are two well-written, thoroughly researched biographies of J. Reuben Clark, Jr., whose eventful controversial career in both public life and as an extremely conservative church official spanned the first half of the 20th century. Frank Fox's J. Reuben Clark, The Public Years, focuses on Clark's years in public life, in particular within the U.S. State Department, where he ultimately became Undersecretary of State. Whereas Michael Quinn's J. Reuben Clark, The Church Years, is concerned with Clark's service as a counselor within Mormonism's highest ruling body, the First Presidency, a tenure which spans some 30 years, from 1935 until his death in 1961. Other Mormon general authorities have attracted the attention of competent biographers. These include Reed Smoot and Hugh B. Brown. Another general authority, Brigham H. Roberts, who was also known as a leading Mormon theologian and one of Mormonism's greatest historians, has been carefully examined in Truman Madsen's Defender of the Faith, the B.H. Roberts story. J. Golden Kimball, whom you had some acquaintance with yesterday in the excellent production. How many here saw that? It was great, wasn't it? But anyway, J. Golden Kimball's a colorful, sometimes outspoken general authority known in some circles as the swearing prophet, has been considered in an engaging fashion by Thomas E. Cheney in The Golden Legend, A Folk History of J. Golden Kimball. While various other 20th century general authorities have received attention in book-length studies, these have generally been more in the realm of hagiography rather than biography. Various so-called second, third, and fourth echelon Mormons have also attracted the attention of biographies, but again, with mixed results. On the plus side is James B. Allen, Trials of Discipleship, The Story of William Clayton, a Mormon. This is a model biography of a lesser-known Latter-day Saint in which Allen follows the life and career of Clayton, a 19th-century Latter-day Saint who was a scribe and confidant to Joseph Smith. Allen's presentation, while generally sympathetic, frankly discusses Clayton's weaknesses, specifically his problems with alcohol and his disappointments, in particular his declining status within the church elite following the emergence of Brigham Young and the migration west. It's a most fascinating biography. In a similarly frank scholarly fashion, three lower echelon Latter-day Saints identified with violence along the Mormon frontier are considered in excellent book-length studies. These include John D. Lee by Juanita Brooks, Orrin Porter Rockwell, the subject of a fast-paced biography by Harold Schindler, and more recently, a biography by William G. Hartley on a rather unknown and unheralded figure by the name of John Lowell Butler. I don't know if anybody in this room has heard of John Lowell Butler, who's been characterized as a kind of settled-down Porter Rockwell. Some of the rough edges, but maybe a little bit more finesse. Maybe he'd be working for the mafia rather than some street gang. I don't know. A number of less flamboyant but significant 19th century Mormons who left their marks along the Mormon frontier have been examined with varying degrees of success in book-length biographies. These include Edwin D. Woolley, a longtime bishop of an important Salt Lake ward, Erastus Beeman Snow, and Dudley Levitt, who were two southern Utah pioneers, Jacob Hamblin, the so-called Mormon apostle to the Indians, and Richard Ballantyne, founder of the Mormon Sunday School organization. I might mention that Dudley Levitt is a direct ancestor, I believe, of the present governor of Utah, Michael Levitt. I think there's a direct lineal. Am I correct in that? Yeah, right, okay. Noticeably lacking, however, are carefully written scholarly biographies on more ordinary, less colorful individuals. That is, so-called rank-and-file Latter-day Saints. This neglect underscores another fundamental problem, and indeed paradox, in Mormon biographical writing. On the one hand, Latter-day Saints have generally manifested a strong, lively interest in family history as a natural outgrowth of genealogical research and related to temple work. But such interest, unfortunately, has failed to generate an outpouring of scholarly, carefully written book-length biographies of lesser-known Latter-day Saints. Also neglected have been minority Latter-day Saints of various ethnic racial backgrounds. This failure, in the words of Davis Bitten, leaves the impression of a white Anglo-Saxon Utah-based existence as the norm or representative of the total Mormon experience, which is most unfortunate. Because this neglect is very, very unfortunate because given the church's long history of growth outside the United States, and more recently, in particular, its evolution into a truly international and increasingly ethnic diverse organization. Despite the prominence of English and Scandinavian converts from the earliest days of the Mormon movement, there are all too few biographies of individual representatives from these particular ethnic groups. And biographies from even more distinctive ethnic groups are in some ways even more lacking, blacks, Hispanics, so on. Also in short supply are scholarly, well-written biographies of Latter-day Saint women. But here, there are a number of bright spots, clearly establishing itself as a standard for all future biographies of Mormon women is Linda K. Newell and Valene Avery's excellent Mormon Enigma. Written in an engaging, readable style, Mormon Enigma is, in many ways, a path-breaking work, presenting Joseph Smith's wife as a well-developed personality. Emma Smith emerges from the pages of Mormon Enigma as a strong, assertive personality in her own right, and not as a mere bland appendage of her all-important husband. Efforts have been made to examine the lives of Joseph Smith's other wives, albeit with mixed results. Fawn M. Brody, in a sense, led the way in an essay entitled The Plural Wives of Joseph Smith and contained in the appendix of her No Man Knows My History, wherein she identified and briefly described the lives and the backgrounds of some 48 women whom she claimed were married to the Mormon leader. A total that has been disputed by later scholars. If you were at the Brody Symposium, we had one individual who's been Todd Compton, who is very hard at work at trying to quantify and verify the statistics that Brody started out with is coming forth with what will be a very significant work. It's a work in progress. Whatever the exact number, the lives and activities of Smith's plural wives have received limited attention from Mormon biographers. A notable exception is Eliza R. Snow, a noted Mormon poetess who later became a plural wife of Smith's successor, Brigham Young. But even she lacks a definitive book-length study. Similarly, the plural wives of various other 19th century Latter-day Saint leaders have yet to be considered in a careful scholarly detail by Mormon biographers. Surprisingly, the 55 plural wives of Brigham Young, Smith's successor and undoubtedly the most famous of all Mormon polygamists, have received minimal attention. Likewise, virtually nothing has been done on the wives of Young's immediate successors as church president, John Taylor, Wilford Woodruff, Lorenzo Snow, Joseph F. Smith, and Heber J. Grant. Moreover, little effort has been made to explore the lives of those plural wives married to various other high Mormon officials. Some attention has been given to other 19th century women, however, many of whom were involved in polygamous relationships. A recent important work is Maria S. Ellsworth's carefully researched, award-winning Mormon Odyssey, the story of Ida Hunt Udall, plural wife. In fact, she's part of the famous Udall family. You've probably heard of, those of us who are older, I guess, anyway, have heard of Stuart and Morris Udall, who were both the political figures of national prominence. This is that same Udall family. Likewise, Juanita Brooks, Emma Lee, in a sensitive work written in a lean, prosaic style, examines the often difficult life of Emma Batchelor Lee, a plural wife of the controversial Southern Utah Mormon leader John D. Lee. But biographies of other noteworthy 19th century Mormon women are lacking, including the likes of Emmeline B. Wells, editor of the outspoken feminist publication Woman's Exponent, and later president of the Relief Society, and Sarah M. Kimball, a Nauvoo resident and one of the founders of that organization. Similarly, few 20th century Mormon women have attracted attention in book-length studies. But again, there are exceptions. A model work is Levi S. Peterson's extensive Juanita Brooks, Mormon Woman Historian, covering the life and times of Brooks, considered the dean of Utah historians, and whose life and activities spanned most of the 20th century. An engaging, careful study of Camilla Irene Kimball, the wife of Spencer W. Kimball, has been written by Caroline Irene Miner and Edward Kimball. Thus, much remains to be done on both 19th and 20th century Mormon women. In conclusion, significant progress has been made in the field of Mormon biography over the course of the past 50 years. With the advent of the new Mormon history, an increasing number of writers have sought to avoid the polemical tone that generally characterized earlier Mormon biography. Since that time, a notable number of scholarly, carefully written biographies have been produced, a few of them first-rate, which I've mentioned. You know, that's the cup being half full. But at the same time, much remains to be done, as I've tried to indicate. But this task is complicated by a number of fundamental problems and pitfalls inherent and endemic to the field of Mormon biography, and to some extent to writing of any type of biography, but particularly Mormon biography. One of the most basic involves a continuing tendency toward polemical extremism in Mormon biographical writing, characterized by two countervailing practices. On the one hand, this involves a tendency to emphasize literally the divine hand of God as involved in virtually every act of the biographical subject in question, or to go to the other extreme and utterly ignore the divine and concentrate solely on the tangible or secular sources or causes or motives on within that biographical topic. I guess the two extremes of this dichotomy, I guess, would be perhaps on the one hand might be Fawn Brody over here looking at Joseph Smith and Francis Gibbons over here. You know, you get the picture. Mormon biographical writing is plagued by a second major problem, specifically the general bland quality in its writing and presentation. One critic, Ronald W. Walker, attributes this bland quality, or what he characterizes it as its spirit of understatement, harmony, and circumspection, to the didactic and commemorative tendency inherent in any religious literature, which if you're writing about any religious person, a tendency further complicated within Mormonism by the Latter-day Saints' own heritage as a persecuted people. The result has been a tendency to go toward the writing of heroic, larger-than-life biography, with clean lines, strong contrasts, and flattering hues. And finally, Mormon biographical writing has been plagued by a related problem. Much Mormon biography attained the delicate balance between life as history and life as art. An observation which was sagaciously made by David J. Whitaker, clear back in 1982, but I think it's still large today. The noted non-Mormon biographer Andre Moreau has observed that it is essential for a biographer to be both a historian and a portrait painter. According to Moreau, an honest biographer should sit in front of his models thinking only, what do I see? And which is the best way to convey my vision to others? Or as David J. Whitaker has suggested, the biographer as historian should strive for ultimate historical truth, being aware that he'll never get that historical truth. There's no way of reproducing that person again, but striving for ultimate historical truth. But at the same time, the biographer as an artist, should seek beauty or seek to present an aesthetically pleasing rendition of a life being lived. In this same spirit, the renowned British biographer Paul Murray Kendall has outlined what should be the ultimate goal or mission of all biography. That is to perpetuate a man as he was in the day he lived. A spring task of bringing one to life again. Or put another way, to elicit from the coldness of paper the life, the warmth of a life being lived. In conclusion, Kendall's call should stand as the clarion call for all biographical writing, be it Mormon or otherwise. Thank you.
Since there wasn't a commentator on this particular paper, as I was reading through it during the last couple of weeks, I had some some thoughts to myself about biographies and in the Mormon culture. As we talk about biographies in the foreign countries or such, is that more a biography to determine how a Mormon lives in that particular type of culture, or is that a sociological issue as how they fit into their particular social climate? I agreed with him on the common everyday Latter-day Saints that are being written about, but I'm not sure that there is a real audience for a lot of that as we go about living our lives. I think most of us feel like our lives are very uneventful to the most degree, and some of us, myself included, refuse to write a journal because I'm not sure I want anybody to know what goes on in my life. And yet I do know that my great-grandfather, who was a personal secretary to several of the early prophets, has many journals that are down in the BYU archives, and I've never taken the time to read them. So even as those journals are there, the journals become only valuable to the families and only valuable as the family makes them. Perhaps would not have a market to the general public. And I've also realized, too, that as you look at biographies, perhaps those that were not written for the wives of several of the polygamous leaders, we don't have a tendency to want to already complicate what is already a controversial issue in our history, and therefore what's not written is more protection than than information or scholarly, those of us that can accept that and realize that that is part of our history, regardless of how we feel about it, would probably find it very interesting to know how these particular lives survived that time in their lives and that type of a situation. But you realize in most biographies, be they Mormon or not, that people that write them have their own reason or own purpose for writing them, and I agreed with him that we, particularly in Mormon biographies, we either have a tendency to want to build testimony or strong influence from the divine, or to motivate people that will encourage them to go on and build their own lives to be better, or else we can find those people that are wanting to perhaps put out the shocking news or the spectacular in order to bring attention to their books. And even in the research that you do, you can basically find what it is you want to write about. As in, Fawn Brody was able to find the negative in Joseph Smith, whereas others can find the positive depending on which resources you choose to use. And as Mark Hoffman chose, you can make them up if you want. So, so the options are there. I really enjoyed his paper, and I think that he's left us a challenge. There are a lot of biographies left to be written. And maybe that's a challenge for some of you that are into history to start doing a little bit of research and see if there isn't someone there that has an interesting life that perhaps you could start doing some research and enjoy finding that information out for yourself. We will turn the time over to some questions for Dr. Bringhurst. Let me remind you that this is being tape recorded, and so if you will either come up and use the microphone or else our Dr. Bringhurst will be willing to repeat the question, but we'll turn the time over to you for that.
Gosh, you know, I have to confess my ignorance. I've got a book on my... The question is, could I suggest a guide for the writing of family history? I've got a book on my bookshelf that's entitled Writing Family History, and I can't remember who the author is, but it's one that I haven't consulted that much because I haven't gotten into the writing of family history, but it's entitled Writing Family History. I got it as a bonus book from the Book of the Month Club, and I think if you look under that title in your local library, I'm ashamed to say I can't remember the exact title. It's just left me. I'm sorry. Other questions? Yes, in the back there. Well, in a sense, the question is, have autobiographies been written? Yes, there has been some autobiographical writing, and you have to be very careful when you use autobiographies, because they, of course, reflect the prejudice and the orientation of the people that are writing these autobiographies. In a sense, Joseph Smith's History of the Church, in a sense, has been characterized as the ultimate autobiography, although, as we know, a lot of those portions in there where they say, you know, Joseph Smith refers to, I'm doing this and I'm doing that, that's been edited in there by Brigham Roberts, who edited that. So, you know, autobiographies are usually a primary source. If you can get a hold of a good autobiography, that's an excellent beginning point for writing any biography. For instance, when I started doing Fawn Brody, one of my essential starting points was an oral interview that she gave. Oral interview that she gave to a professor down at California State University Fullerton. I think this oral interview is available at the University of Utah. A portion of it was published in Dialogue shortly after Fawn Brody's death. But that is a treasure trove. I mean, you read through that carefully. I go back and I'm looking at that all the time and seeing things that are very revealing about things that she says as well as things that she doesn't say. You know, if you can get some kind of recollection written by the person itself, you're that much better. Sometimes you can get recollections written by family members about that person, if you're doing family history. But the best sources, if you're doing a biography, are contemporary sources. You can get as close to the author, to the events that the author was involved in. Because even in autobiographical writing, you know, you got to remember that person is writing years later. You know how our memories are after a certain period of time. We exaggerate, we distort that event, and we go back and if you sit down and write a letter to your family, you know, I write letters home to my family all the time, and I'm not telling the events just exactly as they happen. And I'm aware of that, but for the facility of narration and so forth, and that same is true for autobiography. I'm sorry, I hope that's not a, that answer your question. Well, some of their families have, like in the case of David O. McKay, some of his family members have written recollections. David Lawrence McKay and Llewellyn McKay, for example. There are sources out there, but again, you have to be careful when you use those sources because, you know, they're written usually with an agenda, a family member writing and relating what's going on within that family. And so those are good sources, but you know, there's good news, bad news in using those sources. Let me see. Yes, that particular source on Tanner, I had an opportunity to review that work a number of years ago. It's a very vivid account, but again, you have to be careful that you're dealing with an autobiographic or a reflective account about this person's experiences, but. You know, if they're available, I mean, they're just priceless. Let's see. Yeah, you could either be remembered or not remembered. Yes. As I mentioned in the question is important biographies that are currently being written. There are a number of biographies that I'm aware of. Being a biographer myself, as I mentioned in my presentation. There's the recently published Sidney Rigdon biography that has just come out, and there's a biography, and I cut out this portion of my paper. I didn't talk about the biographies or the situation of writing about dissidents and schismatics. I had to cut that out of the paper for the sake of time. And you notice that? I know you're flipping through the pages to get, because all of a sudden I took a turn in the fast lane. But the schismatic Mormon leader John C. Bennett. How many of you have heard of John C. Bennett, who was a pretty wild figure? Evidently, there's going to be a forthcoming biography of him being published next year by University of Illinois Press. An absolutely fascinating character that I think will give a lot of perspective on the Nauvoo period, because, you know, he bumped up against the Mormons, but he ended up bumping up against a lot of other people. And as I mentioned in my presentation, David O. McKay has evidently found his biographer in Gregory Prince. Gregory Prince, who just recently completed a book on early Mormon origins. I know Greg Prince. He's going to be looking at some of my materials because I bumped up against a lot of members of the McKay family in doing Fawn. I think his biography is going to be a seminal study. So I think there's some really exciting things. Henry Bigler, Guy Bishop, who is a Mormon historian, has got a complete biography on Henry Bigler, who was a kind of a rank-and-file Latter-day Saint, and I think will give a good perspective into what it was like to live in 19th century Utah. It's coming forth from Utah State University Press. So, you know, I think there's some exciting things. And I'd heard rumors that Richard L. Bushman is working on a biography on Joseph Smith himself. He did the shorter study, but he's supposed to be at work at present on it. And that should be anticipated with eagerness to see, because Bushman is a highly regarded historian. Fred? Lacking a journal. Okay, the question is, lacking a journal and lacking what else? Letters? Personal correspondence, and it's a much more difficult task. In fact, I confronted that task on my first major biographical writing. I did a biography on a black Latter-day Saint, an early Saint Latter-day Saint who was ordained to the priesthood in the 19th century. He sort of got in under the wire before the imposition of the black priesthood denial. It was published in Dialogue in 1981, Elijah Abel. And the changing place of blacks within Mormonism. It wasn't a long biography because I didn't have much to work with, but what you have to do is you have to go to other contemporary accounts. You have to go to newspapers. You have to go to observations of other individuals about that person. you know, whatever other contemporary documents that you can get a hold of, you know, census records to find out where that person lived and how they moved around, tax records. You know, it's a much more difficult task if you don't have the documentation. I found that to be the case when I worked on this short biography on Elijah Abel, but it came out okay. I feel very good about that, because what I ended up doing in part was placing Elijah Abel within the context of the time. You know, he was involved in the dynamics of the changing place of blacks. Here he was considered a full Latter-day Saint, and by the time of his death, he was sort of shunted off to the side and denied access to for his temple endowments and stuff like that, strictly because he was black. It's a very sad, poignant story that I guess, you know, it didn't earn me very much points down on 47 South Temple, obviously. But it's a story that I felt needed to be told, because it was an issue, and Elijah Abel had been brought up by a number of other individuals before, and I thought the full story needed to be told. Yes. The question is, what are high school seminaries doing to try to present a more accurate or realistic? Is that what you're asking? More objective picture of early church figures. I'm really not capable of answering that question, because I'm not directly involved in that. Is there anybody here who would venture to try to answer this woman's question? Pardon? I think I'll repeat your comment, because I feel ashamed that I didn't mention that, but because one of my very best friends works down at the Family History Center down across from Temple Square, and if you're interested in family history, that is really the place to go. They have a fantastic staff, and the sources are just unbelievable. If you're doing family history, I mean, that's a treasure trove. You people that live here in Salt Lake are really fortunate that you have access to the family history. And I think a lot of those records and a lot of those materials are available through your own stake center. You know, you can access it. You go over to, you know, most stakes have a place where you can access it, I think, on computers, you know, in the individual stake centers. So, you know, it's ironic in a way. The church encourages makes family history materials available, but yet there's that leeriness about how those materials are going to be used. Because it's a double-edged sword. It's like the session I was in on the Sword of Laban this morning. Sort of a double-edged sword. But the materials are available, and the church is fantastic in having those available. Yeah. Yes.
I wonder.
That's really tricky. If you're trying to run down sources, and they say we declined to state where we got this source from, this person has chosen to remain, anonymous or confident. It's a confidential source. That does present a problem. It's okay for the biography, because he's used that source to write his particular work or biography. But it plays havoc with the person who wants to check where, you know, the way that person used that source. There's not really much you can do about it. Yes, back there, the lady back there. The question is there a Mormon annotated bibliography of biographies that are out there? Not that I'm aware of. Nobody has really sat down. And in my paper, when I sat down to write my paper, I was primarily concerned with the state of Mormon biography after 1945, over the course of the past 50 years. You know, Mormon biography has been written since day one. But nobody that I'm aware of has actually sat down and attempted to generate a document, which is a good project for someone, an exhaustive annotated biography. I do that a little, an annotated bibliography of Mormon biography. As I say, I try to do this in my paper to a limited extent. For the period since 1945, I've got, you probably noticed the footnotes. I gave about a tenth of the information that I generated in the entire paper. If I'd have given you everything that I had in there, we'd be going on until noon and past. Yes. Go ahead. Yes. Yes, it does. The question is, does the fear of church retribution have an impact or influence on the writing of biography? Yes, yes, yes. And I know that personally, having been working on Fawn Brody. There's a classic case, And D. Michael Quinn, a more recent example, he wrote a highly critical article on Ezra Taft Benson that was published in Dialogue, which some of you might be familiar with. That was one of the rationales that was used to excommunicate Mike Quinn. That and then I guess the thing he did on Mormon women and the priesthood, which was done in another volume, and I can't remember where it was. But anyway, yes, that's always, if you're a faithful, believing Latter-day Saint, that's always a very strong consideration, is how is that going to be perceived? And that, it's unfortunate in a way, because it acts as kind of a, it acts as sort of a crimp. You're saying, gosh, what can I say? What should I say? And whatever. I kind of experienced sort of an analogous situation in doing Fawn Brody. Not that I expect any retribution from the church, but if you're doing, let's say, a biography of another individual, you're always worried about how the family is going to react, because especially if that person has just lived recently, because there are still individuals who are affected directly by that person, or knew that person, or they have a stake in protecting the image or the reputation of that person. So when you talk about fear of retribution, it's not just unique to believing, practicing Latter-day Saints writing about Mormon history, but there's always that fear, particularly if that family has cooperated, has given you materials, and they sort of anticipate that you're going to write the biography in a certain particular way. I've had kind of checkered relations with the Brody family in that regard, because they were very cooperative. I interviewed all of them, and then when I wrote one article, the one that was published in Dialogue, there were some things in there that were particularly upsetting to members of the Brody family, to certain members of the Brody family. So there's always that fear, particularly if you're granted access to documents. You pay the piper, so to speak. You got to have that in the back of your mind. Let's see. Is somebody who hasn't asked a question? Let me see. Go ahead. Yeah.
I just want to make a comment. I just
heard Scott Kennington. Well, the comment, and I should mention that, I guess. Another biography in work is, and I remember hearing this, Scott Kenny is working on Joseph F. Smith, and that should be an interesting biography, because he's a careful, meticulous scholar. Yes? Jeez. I mean, there's more writing. The comment, I guess, for me to react to, there's more writing and less reading being done in the church. Why should Mormon biography be written? You raise a very good question. How much time do we have? We're coming back to the end of it about. Let me just make one comment that Fawn Brody herself said. I think it's a very ironic statement. Fawn Brody, as you know, indulged in ironies. And I found this when I was going through her papers at the University of Utah. And this is kind of food for thought for anybody who's contemplating any kind of a biography. Quote, "To write a book is an act of arrogance. To write a biography is an exaggerated act of arrogance, especially if the biography attempts to do what psychiatrists do, illuminate the inner conflicts and try to explain patterns of behavior that are established in childhood and persist into adulthood." I'm quoting Fawn Brody. This was it. It's in her papers. It was written when she was working on Richard Nixon. It was toward the end of her life. I found it in the box containing papers of Richard, her Richard Nixon papers. Box 69, folder 12. You bring up a kind of a painful question, but I'll answer your painful question, because it'll give me a chance to put in a free plug for those of you who attended the symposium. There's a long, sad story involved here, which nobody has the violin. I think the violins and the music's next door. But anyway, what basically happened is University of Utah was supposed to publish the proceedings, the papers of University of Utah Press was supposed to publish a volume containing the papers that were presented at the symposium. And we had gotten it all the way through the editing process. We'd gone through two referees. And the only thing left was to go through a faculty review board at the University of Utah. They have a faculty editorial board. And they turned it down. And so I was so upset I didn't tell my wife for 2 weeks what had happened. It took me 2 weeks to recover from the shock. But I have kind of a low regard for University of Utah Press. Well, there's a happy ending, because Utah State University Press, the only contact I had with that institution was when I went to Boise State in 1959, has graciously consented. They're very interested in it. It's now in their hands. And it looks very, very likely that they'll be publishing that within a year. Knock on wood. I hope I didn't jinx it by making that announcement. But they have indicated a strong, strong interest. Yes?
The tapes are available.
Shortly
from Steve Mayfield.
The guy with the 49ers hat, my wife's baseball team recording. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, let's give a big hand to Dr. Fuhrman. And wish him luck on his finishing up his project, and hopefully we'll see him do more.